Okay. Is the mic working? We've had some problems with the recording. Do you think? Yes? Okay. I mean, it's kind of hard, because really what I want to know is anybody watching that, whether you can hear me, but you listening will have to do. So, XML. There's a slight disjointness here. In the tutorials, you're still doing SQL and relational databases and rectangles, and here we're doing XML and trees and triangles. Sorry about that, but it's sort of an inevitable mismatch. There's also a possibility that in the over in OP, object-oriented programming, you're going to do some, I'm trying to work it with Ewan Klein, that you do some exercises using either database queries or XML structuring. This may or may not work out. How many of you are doing object-oriented programming in FWAN? And which of you are not doing it? Okay, right, so that seems a relevant connection. So far we've had an introduction to XML. XML, you represent tree-structured data, where maybe the tree isn't completely uniform, it's semi-structured. The exact nature of the structuring might change from place to place in the tree, but you can have some degree of structure imposed on it. We've got XML documents, and we also have the notion of a schema for an XML document. The idea being that you specify the sort of structure you'd like to see in the document, that what things might be subtrees under certain elements, what elements must and mustn't be present, or what order they should be, and that kind of thing. And we have schema languages, of which DTDs were one particularly basic example. So we can have XML documents, we can have schemas for those XML documents, and we can tell if a document matches a schema. You have the notion of validation. And this is like type checking in a programming language, but it's a bit looser. One can have an XML document without any DTD at all, or you can have an XML document that satisfies a fairly weak DTD, but maybe not a stronger one, and that's suitable in some circumstances, but not others. There's a trade-off here. But we're still dealing with whole documents. You can have a whole XML document. It might be a web page. That's a reasonable thing just to look at on its own. But it might be something much larger. It might be essentially an entire encyclopedia entry might be stored at an entry, or a whole encyclopedia's worth of entries might be stored as a single XML document. And while it's good to check that it satisfies some overall schema, that doesn't really help you find information in it or directly query it. So this time, I'll be starting to look at, well, how can you navigate large XML documents? How can you extract information out of them? And how can you begin to do the kind of query that we can do on relational databases, but appropriate to tree-structured data? And as we had with the little example databases, of course, the problem is that all of the questions, all the queries you can formulate on a data structure that I can fit onto a slide, you can immediately answer just by looking at it. And you don't need a language for it. You don't really need an algorithm to work it out. But this comes into its own when actually you have XML documents that are larger than you can take in at a single grasp, or you have a collection of them that's very large. And so we're always thinking about how will this scale to documents that are larger than one person can look at a time, or that you can take in simply at a glance. So although all the examples were small, the applications only come into their own when they're large. I'm going to attempt for some of this to use the two slides, because I think I am on top of the video recording problem. Whether that actually works. No, I shouldn't be proud. I shouldn't claim this, because it will then all go horribly wrong. But at least you lucky people who are here will perceive two different things happening on different slides and won't get big blue screens and silence and so on. So how do we get XML data from a document? Well, one way is it's a text document. And so lots and lots of XML documents, the original XML documents, were just web pages. And you get data by reading it. You just look at it, and you get the information, and there you go. And if you've got a big one and you want to search through it, well, it's still just plain text. This is one of the advantages of XML. It's fairly human-readable text. You could just put it through a text search engine. You could say, I want to find if this word occurs, let's search through the whole thing. There might be a bit of noise and incorrectness in that the word you're looking for might appear as the name of an element or the property of an attribute rather than the body text. And so you can get slightly more refined and say, I want to search inside the text that's not in the angle brackets, that kind of thing. And you can do that. You can survey a whole number of web pages looking for words, just looking at the text in them, not looking at the XML structure at all. But if you're really using the structure, if you're using XML to hold a database of scientific experimental results, or a summary, like the Gazetteer, a catalog of information about an institution like the university, who all the students are, where the lectures are, where they happen, and so on, then you want the tree structure to play a part in the search. You don't just want to look for occurrences of single words. And so we have the idea of constructing languages specifically for querying the tree structure that we have in an XML document, perhaps guided by knowing that it satisfies a particular DTD or a particular schema. And as with SQL and querying languages for databases, it's worth some effort, and people do different kinds of research and trying out different formulations of the languages to make succinct queries, queries that can be efficiently answered, queries that can express the things that you want to express about particular sorts of documents. And so, as with relational databases, you can get multiple kinds of language and different levels of abstraction for stating the query you want, maybe in order to communicate with somebody else what the information you're interested in, or to communicate to a machine, which then has to implement it. So you get different levels of precision in languages, different levels of sophistication. You might get a language that's quick and easy to learn and maybe really reasonably fast to run, but can only do a limited kind of querying, whereas you might have some richer, more complicated language which can do really advanced queries, which can be optimized for working on very large data sets, but it takes a little longer to learn or understand, or maybe it's just harder to implement. So we're going to be looking at one language within that spectrum, and there are others. And if you... Having a dedicated language for querying based on the tree structure is useful. It takes you a step ahead of just searching for some text. So you can do things pretty much like you can with databases. You can write the kind of query you might write in SQL over a relational database on some tree structured data, perhaps that's published at the web. I mentioned that XML is now basically the standard for publishing large data sets on the web. You don't publish the contents of a relational database because that's typically in some highly proprietary form optimized for sitting on disk or whatever. You publish it as XML, which somebody, a user, can then scan easily and put into whatever database format they need. But in some cases, you can query it directly as it appears as XML, and that can be useful. So there's a lot of data out there on the web that appears as XML, and sometimes you can query it directly in its XML format. You don't have to reformat it into some relational database tables. One of the applications of XML was as a markup language, and we see a bit more of this in the next section on Corpora. You can have something that's basically a text document, but then is marked up to indicate the structure it has. This is a play, these are the scenes, these are the characters, where they appear and disappear, and so on. So you can have markup, basically text documents that are then marked up with their structure, and you then want to extract information that depends on that structure. You want to say, you want to do something about which characters in which scenes, or which parts of speech are used near which other parts of speech in a particular body of work by somebody. So if we have marked up text, then we might have queries that relate to the structure that that markup is capturing. And sometimes you might have information that's not explicit in the text of the document, it's not explicit in the attributes or the elements or the labeling, but is in the tree structure itself. The fact that some part element appears inside another element, that certain things are nested in a particular way or appear in a particular order. And XML maintains that structure of one thing being a subtree of another, or that certain siblings appear in a particular order. And that might be encoding information about the data that you're interested in. And so you need a query language that can query it, can say, is there a case where these two elements occur side by side, or where they all occur as a child of some other node? So you might have information that's captured in the tree structure itself, which in a small web page will be evident just because you see the indentation of the bulleted lists or something like that. But in a large data set, you want to say, well, I'm interested in this particular structure appearing in the tree. And that's an instance of a much more general thing where you might want to look for structure in graphs. A graph is nodes joined by lines. You might want to say, where does this kind of structure appear? So we don't want the data or the text attached to it, but we're looking for particular kinds of structure. So there are reasons for having a query language specifically for trees. And this actually, I mean, this applies generally. As soon as you have a data structure that you're using to store a reasonably large kind of amount of data, you think, well, how can I ask questions about it? You could just write code that walks along these pointers by hand to answer a question, but you want to step back and say, well, if I'm doing this a lot, maybe there's a specialized language I could use just for doing that. So XQuery is a well-established and large and very powerful declarative query language for extracting information from XML. So it's declarative, this is like SQL. You say what you want, you don't necessarily specify exactly how to extract it or the algorithm for extracting that from the data. And again, that's good because that separates concerns. You can separate the concern of what is exactly is it I want to know from how is this data represented on disk, what is the most efficient way to find out the thing you wanted, and perhaps if we're going to ask this query again and again, it's worth spending some time coming up with a really efficient algorithm. and you separate the what it is you want with how you get it. So XQuery is a declarative query language for getting XML, extracting information from XML documents that captures the kind of things I was talking about, the structure inherent in the tree, the information that's there, but also its annotations and so forth. But it's really quite complex. It's built to handle extremely complex queries over very large data sets with a lot of structure. And it was kind of developed by people with a history of, well, SQL really, relational database queries, knowing that there are really complex queries you might want to write, and it can be hard to express them. And so they came up with this language that was really very, very, very rich. And that's great if you want to do some extremely complex query. It's not so good if all you want to do is knock off some very quick query. And it's not at all good if you want to teach some first year students who haven't seen queries over trees at all and for whom it just gets really, really complicated. So it's not ideal as a first query language. It's interesting, and it may well be the language you need to do something. But what we're going to talk about is XPath. XPath is a sub-language that was really identified because the problems I've talked about just now were true in the wider world, that XQuery was great for the three guys who invented it and the problems they had. But everybody else found it really, really hard work to understand. And even if it was the right language for their application, it was quite a steep learning curve to understand it and then apply it to their thing. So XQuery is a very fine language. It had input from some good people, and so it is good, but it's hard work. XPath became popular as a subset of that, which could only do a certain amount, a few of the things XQuery. It can't do the full range of queries, it can't do as detailed analysis as XQuery can, but it's simpler to understand, it can do a lot of what you need. And it's also a pretty good stepping stone into XQuery. And there are lots of others as well. I'm not really mentioning them here, but it's a small cottage industry coming up with languages for querying XML documents because you're unhappy with the language that somebody taught you or that your tool used, or XPath or XQuery. You don't like it for some reason, so you come up with some other language that is really good for you. And so you'll see a whole flurry of these things out there, and that's still going on. It's absolutely not settled down. The situation is not like relational databases where SQL is primary and everybody put their effort into that, and it does kind of what people wanted and expected, and we work with that. XML is still very much unsettled. XPath is commonly used, but there are others out there. So it is a query language. We'll be using it as a query language, but it's really just a language for navigating around, for identifying paths through trees. As a language for paths through trees, it forms a component of lots of other XML declarations and languages. So XML schema, which is a more sophisticated schema language than DTD, uses XPath to describe trees through it. XSLT is a language for translating one XML document into another. So you have some big XML document that contains a lot of data. You want to extract a portion of it to display, maybe as a web page. And XSLT is a language that will transform a big document and into another document, maybe smaller, just extract the information you want. Xlink, Xpointer, a whole bunch of other things beginning X. Are languages for describing, manipulating, creating XML, and lots of them, when they need to describe a point in a tree or a path from one place to another in a tree, then they'll use XPath. So it has lots of applications. And the idea is that all we have is a language for describing paths through the tree. And once you have such a path, then actually that's a way of retrieving information from the tree, because we give a specification of a path that's a bit loose. It's got some variables in some uncertainty. So we say any path that matches this, and we want the nodes at the end of it. So a location path describes a path from the root of the tree, maybe down to here, but with some flexibility. It might say, go to here and then pick any child, and then you get all of these. Or go to here and pick any descendant, and you get lots of these. So it describes a set of possible paths from the root of the tree. And as a query language, what it means is, please give me all of those nodes, all the nodes that you can reach in this way. We'll see lots of examples in a minute. And what you get back is a list of nodes, and the nodes are sorted in what's called document order. So here's a tree, and document order, also depth first, left to right. You start at the top, and then you go down a branch here to the bottom. So this is node 1, 2, 3, 4. And then only when you get to a leaf do you start to move to the right. You get 5, we've reached an edge, so we go back up again, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, down again, 12, 13. And this, in fact, is Remember, we had this mapping between the textual form of XML and the tree, and the textual form had to have elements nested properly and in the right order. And the document order is the order the nodes would appear in the text version of XML. So if you took that tree represented as an XML document with angle brackets and nesting of nodes and elements, then the nodes would appear in the text document in that order. So there's this notion of ordering on the trees. So when we make an XPath query, we describe a path and we say, please return every node that is at the end of a path like this, and then in the particular order of the document. XML maintains order, which is sometimes useful, sometimes slightly awkward. This is just a reminder of the names for various relations in the tree. The siblings of a node are the ones that share a parent. The ancestors are all the ones above it in the tree. Descendants are all the ones below. We have child, parent, and so forth, various relations. So I'm now going to do various location paths as examples. Now, this is slightly tricky because this kind of thing really doesn't suit a linear order of presentation, because we have some examples, which include some simple things and some complex things. There's also some slides explaining the examples, saying what they were about, and then some slides explaining XPath and the simple kind of XPath queries and more complex ones. And the order they come in these slides is the examples first and then the explanation. Now, the explanation makes most sense when you've seen the examples, and the examples makes most sense once you've understood the explanation. So there is no right way to do this. I have to present something that doesn't entirely make sense on its own and then explain it. I could do it the other way around, and then a different thing would not make sense on its own. I'm sorry, that's just how it is. You have to sort of push it on the stack and hope the explanation will come later. What it does mean is that it will almost certainly be worth going over the slides, the lecture notes afterwards, so that you can experience them in both orders. This is universally the case, and I'll try and manage it, but be aware, there is no one order that will make this work. So what we're going to do is we get some location paths described in XPath syntax. Turns out there are two kinds of XPath syntax. There is a more complex one and a simpler one. I'll say a bit more about that later. And I'm going to illustrate the nodes that will be retrieved by that query. The general idea is that we build up paths step by step. We write a location path, and that describes steps through the tree, sometimes small steps, sometimes large steps. And in a sense, there's a context node, it's called, the node we're looking at the moment, and the next step in the path will be a step from that node somewhere else. But it can be a bit more sophisticated as we get more elaborate XPaths. So this is an example. This is the gazetteer XML tree that we talked about that says for a list of countries we give regions, the region features in the regions, mountains, lakes, rivers, and so forth. And although we've only got a small amount to fit on a slide, in principle it might have several countries and several regions. It might also be rich of going up. We might have a really large data set that records how the gazetteer has changed over time. We might have a separate tree for each. We might have the tree of the gazetteer now, and then for every version it's been in the past, we might have a tree. So we might have a top index that says the date and every possible one. That seems excessive, but actually it compresses quite well because there's a lot of shared information between these. So you do get data formats that have that. You can have the current version and all previous versions. And then you can ask elaborate queries about, well, can you find all instances of a feature that used to be in one country and is now in another, and things like that. So we're just looking at a small example, but one could make this much richer, and the XPath language scales to this. So here's a simple query. The slash means start at the root node, start at the top of the tree. And slash child colon colon gazetteer means a path that says start at the root node, and then find a child that's a node of type gazetteer, an element that's a gazetteer. And in this case, there's exactly one to go to. The abbreviated form of that says, don't mention the direction at all, you're always looking for a child. So slash gazetteer means find a gazetteer node at the top of the tree. In this case, there's exactly one. The next path says find a gazetteer node and then go to a child node, which is a country. And the full expression is slash child colon colon gazetteer slash child colon colon country. The abbreviated form just misses out the child one because that's the default. And here, that highlights this node. It will also include the nodes for all of the other countries. So run as a query over this tree, it will return all of the countries that are in the gazetteer. And Yeah, so this path is essentially describing all of those possible paths, not just the one path we can see here. Going deeper, gazetteer country region means find a region inside a country inside the gazetteer. And again, that would actually refer to a whole set of nodes, all the regions and all of the countries mentioned in the gazetteer. So that's one step at a time. Descendant region means find a descendant that's of type that's a region node. And in this case, this would pick up exactly the same ones as the last query. But that's only because the gazetteer is really well structured. It satisfies a particular DTD that says the only thing you have in the gazetteer is countries, and regions always appear just inside countries. So, but in a more flexible format, supposing we had this one where we'd enriched it to cover all of the dates, or we had some further nesting where countries might have states within them and states had regions. So remember, one of the reasons for having semi-structured data is you might have a data set which is locally has one structure, and then another part has a slightly different structure. This gazetteer was gathering, doing data integration on several data sets. You might have some which organized their region data in one way, and others that organized it in another. And here, a query like this will be more useful, where you say, find a descendant that's a region, and we're not going to specify exactly the route you get to it. It might go gazetteer country region, it might go gazetteer country state region, it might be a gazetteer country regions, and then a particular region. So descendant, and the short form of that is a double slash, to say, go as far as you like, Dano. Descendant region child star means find a descendant node that's a region, and then a child that is anything. Well, it's a child that is another element. In this case, this picks up the name and all of the individual features. So the star means match anything. This says find a subnode of the root that's a region, and then any subnode of that. And here you'll see that actually star is slightly limited. It means any node. It doesn't include the attributes or these text leaves at the bottom. Remember, XML has this slightly curious thing of having, you have internal nodes and you have leaf nodes. The leaf nodes may contain maybe plain text, and that's somehow different from an element node. And we also have these attributes, which are leaves of a special kind, that any element can have an attribute attached, and every attribute has an attribute name and value. And so this star, in this case, only means element nodes. If I want any kind of node at all, then there's this special syntax that says, node, parenthesis, open parenthesis, close parenthesis, means an element node or a text node, but not an attribute. So there are various refinements of this to do with the fact that XML is a concrete language with a certain number of trade-offs. This looks only for the text node, so find any text inside a region inside the gazetteer, inside the whole tree. So this misses out things that are just attached to the country and only returns text nodes attached to a region. So this is a path that will give all of the text nodes in any of the regions. And of course, that's just a mass of text, which we might then search using a text search algorithm. But we can also, when we make this path, we can go up again. We can go sideways. So that just might mean we've reached these text nodes. We want more information about, well, what kind of a region do they appear in, or what features are they? So here, for example, we have one that goes to the attributes and says, find a descendant of the root node that's a feature. So something anywhere in the tree which is some kind of a feature, and then look for a child that is an attribute. And the attribute must be a type attribute. Remember, you can have attributes that are all kinds of things. Rather confusingly here, they're just called type. And so here it says find any feature node and then extract the type attribute of it. And we can abbreviate that by saying slash slash feature, that's the descendant query, and then a slash look for a child which has an attribute that's a type. An attribute might have any kind of name. So this picks out just these nodes here. So these are paths that find out particular kinds of information. They're not really doing very elaborate navigation. They're just going down, maybe one step, maybe several. One can have more elaborate ones, and I think we come to them later, where you can go up and sideways. So you can say, well, go down to all of this and then go back again to something else. So this is, in general, how the path syntax looks. Those were particularly simple examples. Now I'll move to the explanation of what it is they're an instance of. So as I said, there are two kinds of syntax for XML, for XPath. This is slightly unfortunate. So there's this full unabbreviated syntax in which you can write everything in XPath, but it's rather prolix. It's rather lengthy. You wouldn't actually want to write it, but it's completely specifying things. There's then an abbreviated form, which is kind of easier to read. It's a little higher on the symbol density and less on the words. And it's possible that everything you can do in the general syntax, you can do in the shorter syntax as well. But it's not, I don't think that's particularly guaranteed. And also, it's slightly, it's easier to write, but slightly harder to read because it's condensed. And of course, internally, a processor of this would represent it using some entirely internal syntax tree and wouldn't care about the initial abbreviated or unabbreviated syntax. This is quite a common situation where you'll have a language, it might be a programming language, a descriptive language, a data language, where you have a full lengthy form and then have something that makes it a bit shorter if it's going to be human readable and human writable. So a location path in general is a sequence of location steps. As I said, they might be small or might be large, separated by a slash. And every step has a form that says the axis, the direction in which it's moving, what kind of thing it's looking for when it moves, and then maybe a predicate that refines exactly what it's looking for. So the axis, this is a reference to the idea of, you know, three or four dimensions. You have axes that point orthogonally, and making progress can be measured in one axis or another. The axes for, maybe this is now worth doing. Yeah, so the axes for something like a tree are actually to do with going down or up, or the, any descendant down a long way, or ancestor up a short, a long way, or through siblings. So the axes are not exactly orthogonal, but an axis means the kind of step you're going to take. And the node test selects nodes, which nodes you want, in a fairly crude way. It says I'm only interested in region nodes, or I'm only interested in country nodes, or feature nodes. That's what it is. It says I'm interested in a node of a certain kind, or I'm only interested in nodes that are the text leaves on that tree. In addition, you might then have a predicate which is slightly more refined that says I want to find all the nodes of a particular kind in this direction such that if I go, their parent is of a certain kind, or they have no siblings, or something like that. So the predicate can get really quite elaborate. That's where there's a really rich language in it. This is a little similar to the relational algebra, where we had simple things like the idea of projection or selection, but then down in the what it was you were selecting on or what it was you were projecting on could be really quite a refined logical predicate. So here are the here are some of the axes. There are more axes as well. The child axis means go one step down. The descendant axis means go any number of steps down to at least one or more steps. Parent, go up one step. Attribute, go one step towards the attributes, which are somehow different kinds of nodes. Self is the axis that points only to itself. That's slightly odd, but it can be useful. Descendant or self is the axis that means the node itself or one of its descendants. There's also an ancestor one that says any ancestor, or ancestor or self means the node itself or an ancestor. You get all of these kind of combinations. So we have the axis that says which way you're going, and the test which says, well, what do you want to find in that direction? And again, it might be a particular kind of node. It might be any node, slightly different there. If you're looking for attributes, it's any attribute. If you're not looking for attributes, it's any node except an attribute. Node is any kind of node. Text is only those character node, text nodes at the bottom of the tree. So these are the kind of basic tests you can look for. Predicates, predicates go in square brackets. And they can be all kinds of things. So typically, it's a list of additional information you want. And some of the examples of predicates, the most commonly used ones, are brackets location path. So this says, go to a point here where I could then follow a further path and reach somewhere interesting, but don't actually do that. So it might be find all nodes that have a child. So that means find nodes that I could go to, and I could then go to a child node. All nodes I could go to, and I could then go to a child node which contains a feature which is a mountain. This kind of thing. This is similar. It says go to a node for which that you could continue along a path, and the value at the bottom will be a certain thing. So go down and find a country from which I could then select a region which has a certain name, or a region which contains a mountain. So this is where the paths become more elaborate, and the whole navigation model becomes rather richer. So I think I have an example here. Yeah, so this says find a node that's a descendant of the root node, which is a feature. Okay, that will be all of the features. But a feature from which you could then follow the path attribute to go get to an attribute node, which is a type, so it tells you the type of the feature, and the type is mountain. So this says find all the features which are mountains. And that's a reasonable query to make, but to express it in terms of a path, we have to do this kind of path followed by another path. It says find a path that goes to a feature from which there is a path which you could get to a mountain. And that's symptomatic of all of these, or typical of XPath queries, is you describe a path, and that seems easy enough, I want to find all the nodes of a certain kind, but richer queries saying features that are mountains or regions that contain a river or places, countries whose population, where the population of the country is greater than this number, tends to mean this kind of navigation where you go down, then you go back up again, then you go round and so forth. And these queries can get quite complex to write, even trickier to read, and implementing them efficiently starts to become rather more difficult. So I've described what that query is, but how you would efficiently implement it on a very large data set, for a start, it almost certainly doesn't mean that you write some code that wanders over the tree and sees if it's found a mountain or not. You have to do this in bulk, ideally in parallel over a very large data set, and there are ingenious algorithms to do it. This is known as the navigational model of data querying, and while it feels very natural, the thing I'm looking for is, well, I can go here and then here and then here. It's one you can, it's very tangible in some sense. It's actually quite difficult to implement efficiently, and it doesn't always express, or it can be hard to step away and express general abstract properties when you have this very concrete description of what it is. Before relational databases, so this is quite a long time ago, the navigational model was quite popular for going around rectangular data sets. You say, well, I want to find a student who's on a course where the course is given by a lecturer, which has a certain property. And you describe your queries, you'd navigate around the database, and this was a very interactive metaphor for finding information in it. But it turns out to be quite hard to scale to big queries or to general queries, and that's where SQL and relational databases came in. XML is still pretty much at the navigational model, and it may be that that's because it's exactly the right thing you want for XML trees, or it may be that the correct abstract view of navigating tree or querying tree structured data hasn't really come together yet. It's not entirely clear. So I would say XPath is well worth knowing about. Lots of things are in there, lots of things use it, but it's still a fairly dynamic field, is exactly how we would do this. And it shows in some of the kind of awkwardnesses in the way you use XML and so on. So before I do more queries, let's see. Okay, I'll do one more and then something else for a bit. So this is a query that says, okay, find the names of all the mountains, is what this query is doing. But to turn that, and that's kind of, you know, find the names of all the mountains is quite a nice way to phrase it. This doesn't immediately look like that, though once you've got the hang of it, you can read that that's what it's doing. The long form says, start at the root, find a descendant that is a feature. Okay, that goes down and find all of these features, and all of the features in all of the other regions in all of the other countries. I want a feature such that I could from then go on down and find an attribute that's a type attribute and where the type is mountain. Okay, that picks out this feature and this feature. And then, so that selected some nodes, and I then want to go on to do some more navigating, and I say, well, now find a child of that node, which is a text description. So this will be the name of the mountain. And so this whole query, which can be abbreviated like this, so this is just dropping the child using double slash for descendant at type for an attribute type query, still keep the square brackets around the predicate. So it's abbreviated like that. This means find the name of all the mountains in the XML document. And so that's a useful query to do, and it's quite complicated, the navigation of all going down to one node, back up again, down to a different child, and so on. And so you can do it, but as you can see, there's quite a leap and certain expertise in taking a written query that says find the names of all the mountains, working out how you might describe that in XPath, and then writing it down. And once that's done, there's then a whole other part which isn't done by you, but is done by the search engine or the query engine, which is to work out how do we turn this into a reasonable algorithm over the data structure that we've got. And it's also, the value of this is partly is balanced between the code you write, but also the schema that the document must satisfy. Because in translating the find all names, all the mountains into this, I've implicitly used some quite strong information about how this document is structured, the kind of thing that would appear in a DTD. I've assumed that I haven't said features must imply inside regions, must be inside countries. I'm happy to pick up features wherever they turn up. So this would be robust if some of the other countries just listed the features directly under the country, didn't group them by region. So it'll be robust in that sense. But I've assumed that the type of the feature will be stored as an attribute on the feature called type. And that could be built into a DTD. We could say every feature must have a type attribute, or it must either have a type attribute or be the default mountain or whatever. And then that the name of the mountain is stored as the text inside the feature attribute, inside the feature node, rather than, say, as an attribute on the node, or rather than in a subnode called name, as we had here for the name of the country. So we're relying, to some extent, on the DTD, the schema that the document satisfies. So going from the textual description of the query you want, find all the names of all the mountains, to an XPath query, depends on things like knowing the DTD, knowing how restricted the document format will be, and what you can rely on. Okay, so I'll say a little bit. Oh no, there's another one. This is another way. This says find the regions containing a mountain. So we say find a feature which is a mountain. So a feature that has an attribute called type where the value is mountain. And then from there, find a parent. So dot dot represents go up to a parent. And then find a name node under that and get the text from it. And so this again is relying quite closely on the local structure of regions in this document that says regions consist of a name of the region and a bunch of features. And given that, then this is then a sensible query. But the navigation is now just down a path. The path goes down, extends a bit to check something, then goes back up again and down again. And as you can imagine, one could rearrange this in various ways to say, well, instead I want to find a region that contains a mountain that has a name, and then give the name of that region, this kind of thing. So there are several different ways to do it, and the navigational queries start to become, the simple ones that say just go down and find something look really easy. The ones that start to go down, test out a few directions, go back up again, test out some more, then go down again, start to get a little more elaborate, a little harder to read. They become much more like programs, where you then have to read the program and work out what was the intention of the programmer. It is declarative. We're not requiring that it be actually implemented exactly like this, but it becomes the more complex the queries become, the less obviously declarative that they are. But at that point, also, you should then start to think of moving to something like XQuery, which puts a better declarative spin on this by separating out the stages of filtering, selecting, identifying things you want. So once you start to get to queries of this complexity, you might think, well, maybe I ought to move to a bigger, more powerful language. I can do it in XPath, but it's stretching it. Okay, I will now say I won't necessarily go over the last of the, because I want to revisit this next time slides. Instead, I'll say a little bit about Unicode encoding, because we had this. This is non-examinable, but I think interesting. We had last time this question of character representation in XML. XML can store documents are stored in Unicode, not ASCII, so you can have all kinds of interesting characters, which I don't think is actually used here, which is unfortunate. And we had, remember, we had data set, ASCII is 7 bits. So that's easy to send out, to store in memory or to send out over data, because 7 bits fits nicely inside a byte, there's even room to spare. So ASCII, you represent 1, 2, 3, 4, using the lower 7 bits of a byte, and that's fine. ASCII can handle alphabetic. All of those characters appearing up there are ASCII. but Unicode can represent, well, so I'll stop there. Can't refer. If we went to 16-bit, so early versions of Unicode were just 16 bits wide, so you can still represent thousands of characters. That's fairly naturally represented in 2 bytes. It fits exactly into 2 bytes. So if you're going to represent 16-bit characters, then you'll put them in memory as pairs of bytes, You'll write them to disk as pairs of bytes. You'll send them over the wire as pairs of bytes. It takes up a bit more space than ASCII, which is, so we now need 2 bytes per character, but presumably we're going to a larger character set because we couldn't fit inside 7-bit ASCII. Well, actually, that doesn't always work, because typically Unicode documents consist mostly of ASCII, of one byte, things that could be represented in 1 byte, and only occasionally go out into 2-byte ones, but it's kind of okay. There begin to be problems, though. When you're storing in memory, it's fair enough, or in a register. If you're putting it out transmission on the wire over a network, then almost all communications protocols work a byte at a time. And you've got to cope with the possibility that they might be cut off at any point, or they might be restarted at any point. You might lose bytes. And there's a basic problem. If you're sending 16-bit word over a byte-by-byte protocol, you've got the high bit and the low byte. Which one do you send first? Do you send the big one? Do you send this one first, or do you send high then low, or low then high? And it kind of sounds a silly distinction, and it is, but as the two people at each end have to agree, and so you've got whole layers of protocols to make sure that you're both agreed on whether we'll send the big end first or the little end first. And there are 2 kinds of protocol. There's big endian communication and little endian. And this genuinely causes all kinds of difficulties. And what you end up doing is embedding things in your text so that you can tell whether something coming over the wire was actually big endian or little endian, and then adjust to compensate. This is a reference, incidentally, to Swift's Gulliver's Travels, in which the Lilliputians and their enemies at the other end of the island had a long-running, multi-generational war over whether you break your hard-boiled egg at the big end or the little end. And this was kind of an amusing satire on small differences and how they grow up, which I'm told failed to make it into the Jack Black Gulliver. So it's not worth watching. It doesn't mention this. So big end and little end, it turns out, it is actually a really significant difference. And they don't go to war over it, but it's something to be aware of. Unicode is even bigger than this. Unicode uses, 20 and 1/11 of a bit. So basically you need 21 bits to represent Unicode. And if you're storing it in memory or passing around registers, if you're dealing with a single character, then do it in 4 bytes. Do it in a 32-bit word. It's easily the simplest way to do it. Most processors now will have native 32-bit registers. They can manipulate them. They can read and write them from memory swiftly. They work really well on data that's aligned on 4-byte boundaries in memory. You manage with 32 bits for a... that has a name as an encoding. It's called UTF-32 or UCS-4 for 4-byte. That's an encoding of Unicode characters. You use the bottom 21 bits of a... So that's... Use the bottom 21 bits of a 32-bit word. And if you're managing a single character, that's the way to do it. If you're managing a small string, maybe an array of characters, that's the right way to do it, because you can immediately index every point in the array without any trouble. But as soon as you start dealing with long strings or several strings, you have 1,000 strings for all the possible messages in a program, that's a reasonably large data set, you have large quantities of text in memory or on disk, or you're transmitting over the internet, then this becomes runs into some problems. It's an inefficient coding. Lots of the space will be wasted. And if you've got, that's for memory, that's not such a problem, but for communication, it starts to be an issue. There are big endian and little endian problems still arise. Do we send this end first or that end first? If you get a break in transmission, if you get all of it but not the last few bytes, then you miss bits of characters. If you start midway through a message, you don't know if you started at the end of a character or in the middle somewhere. And then resynchronization can be a problem because you don't know where you are in a byte stream. You have to start putting tag bytes in or tag bits to say, here is a character, here is another character, here is another character. Or synchronization once every 16 characters to make sure people can keep up. So actually, that's really convenient for single characters, but for large quantities of text, it's not ideal. It has some problems, partly to do with size, but that's not the only problem at all. So this was an issue in the early 90s. It was clear that people wanted a character set that was at least 16 bits and possibly as much as 32, or certainly somewhere in between there. And we wanted a representation for it that could be usefully transmitted, that didn't waste too much space, that could cope if you lost bits, lost bytes in the middle, or if you started midway through a message. And there were various proposals. And it turns out that there was one that kind of did a number of these things, but not all of them, that was being developed, I think, by IBM. And it was about to go, it kind of looked the best deal at the time, and it was going to a vote at the various industry body that would decide this is our standard for implementation and so forth. And but it still lacked some things, and so a couple of guys, Thompson and Pike, who were working at AT&T in Bell Labs at the time, developing an operating system called Plan 9, and they'd started to implement the current standard. Well, they were implementing a 16-bit format, and it was a real pain, and they knew this new thing was around, and they thought, that's great, we can go with that. But it wasn't ideal, and it turned out that they had identified flaws in it. They had the vote was going to be on which standard thing would become standard was in 3 days' time. And so on the 2nd of September 1992, they, in a diner somewhere in New Jersey, on the back of a napkin, they invented a new coding standard, which made it to the meeting 3 days late. They implemented it that night. They demonstrated it. They wrote up the technical specification. They sent it to the meeting. And 3 days later, it was voted on, and it became the standard UTF-8. And now something over half the documents on the web are encoded with UTF-8. So that was quite a big success. And it was really lucky they got in there, because otherwise we'd be lumbered with a standard that was kind of workable, but not as good as this. It missed some of the important properties. So this is quite fun. I also realized when doing this that, I think of this as kind of recent, but this is when you guys were born, right? There's a small chance. Is there anyone in the course who was actually born on the 2nd of September 1992? Yes. Oh, fantastic. Do you? Yes, and you have a name with an interesting character in it as well. So you should be grateful for this. Its time had come. I don't know. It's an interesting anniversary. But you should be proud. And it's quite fun that it's pinned down to a particular person on a particular day who tried to solve this problem. And like lots of things, the point is it's better than the thing they first came up with. It is worth working at these things, because if it's going to be used a lot, small trade-offs count. So I will now, in the few minutes left of me, explain what it was they did and what, well, try to get a hint of why it was so clever. So UTF-8 has the property that if you're representing, so the question is we've got to get up to 21-bit characters into a stream of bytes. And it's a multi-byte encoding. Some of the time we're going to use one byte, some of the time we're going to use several. This saves space. But it makes it a little bit more complex, but not too complex. If we're representing a byte that contains from 0 to 7 bits, so that's ASCII. ASCII fits inside 7 bits. If we're representing that, then we represent it exactly as we would normally. We just represent it. It fits inside one byte, and it begins with a 0, and then it has 7 bits. So every ASCII byte fits just exactly into UTF-8. Every purely ASCII document is already UTF-8 encoded by default. That's a really, really useful property. It also happens to be the case that if in a UTF data stream, if you ever see a byte beginning with 0, then it represents that ASCII character. If you want to represent something from 8 to, I have to get this right, something more than 8 bits, you write a byte that begins 1, 1, 0, and followed by a byte that begins 1, 0. So 1, 1, 0 means this is the beginning of a 2-byte character sequence, and the 2 ones is a handy mnemonic for that. 1, 0 means this is a continuation byte. This byte is part of a bigger character. And that leaves 11 bits spare, 5 here and 6 here, to represent the payload, character that we're looking at. So the first 2,000 characters in Unicode can be represented in 1 or 2 bytes. If we start at 12 bits, we represent that by a byte that goes 1, 1, 1, 0. And then there's 4 bits spare here. And we then have 2 continuation bytes. So it begins 1, 1, 1, 0. That's a 3-byte format. It contains 2 continuation bytes. Each one starts 1, 0, and then has 6 more bits. So we have 6 and 6 and 4 bits. So that's 16 bytes. Anything up the first 16 bits can be done in 1, 2, or 3. And then finally, from 17 to 21 bits, we have a starter byte that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. Then there's space for 3 bits. So it begins with an F in hex. And then we have 3 continuation bytes that, as the same as before, have 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. And there's 6 bits free in each of those, and 3 bits free here, which makes 21 bits overall. So we can fit a 21-bit Unicode character in 1, 2, 3, or 4 bytes. So we still need no more than 4 bytes for any character. Most characters, no, lots and lots of characters that will be used. So Chinese takes you up here. Well, not all of it, actually. Chinese, European languages fit in here. Chinese characters take you up to there. If you start to want to use the Phistos disk, Linear B, old character sets that are at historic character sets, particularly unusual ones, you have to move up to here. But you can always represent it in up to 4 bytes. There is an extension. Originally, there was a possibility that Unicode might need 31 bits, and so